invaded. During the past 3 weeks, you have been reading and hearing about the massive invasion of South Vietnam by the communist armies of North Vietnam. Tonight, I want to give you a first-hand report on the military situation in Vietnam, the decisions I have made with regard to the role of the United States in the conflict, and the efforts we are making to bring peace to the negotiating table. Let me begin by briefly reviewing what the situation was when I took office, what we have done since then to end American involvement in the war, and to bring peace to the long-suffering people of Southeast Asia. On January 20, 1969, the American troop ceiling in Vietnam was 549,000. Our casualties were running as high as 300 a week. 30,000 young Americans were being drafted every month. Today, 39 months later, through our program of Vietnamization, helping the South Vietnamese develop the capability of defending themselves, the number of Americans in Vietnam by Monday, May 1st, will have been reduced to 69,000. Our casualties, even during the present all-out enemy offensive, have been reduced by 95%. Draft calls now average fewer than 5,000 a month, and we expect to bring them to zero next year. As I reported in my television address to the nation on January 25, we have offered the most generous peace terms in both public and private negotiating sessions. Our most recent proposal provided for an immediate ceasefire, the exchange of all prisoners of war, the withdrawal of all of our forces within 6 months, and new elections in Vietnam, which would be internationally supervised with all political elements, including the communists, participating in and helping to run the elections. 1 month before such elections, President Hu and Vice President Wang would resign. Hanoi's answer to this offer was a refusal even to discuss our proposals, and at the same time, a huge escalation of their military activities on the battlefield. Last October, the same month when we made this peace offer to Hanoi and Zia, our intelligence reports began to indicate that the enemy was building up for a major attack. Yet we deliberately refrained from responding militarily. Instead, we patiently continued with the Paris talks, because we wanted to give the enemy every chance to reach a negotiated settlement at the bargaining table, rather than to seek a military victory on the battlefield, a victory which we, which they cannot be allowed to win. Finally, 3 weeks ago, on Easter weekend, they mounted their massive invasion of South Vietnam. Three North Vietnamese divisions swept across the demilitarized zone into South Vietnam in violation of the treaties they had signed in 1954 and in violation of the understanding they had reached with President Johnson in 1968, when he stopped the bombing in North Vietnam in return for arrangements which included their pledge not to violate the demilitarized zone. Shortly after the invasion across the DMZ, another three North Vietnamese divisions invaded South Vietnam further south. As the offensive progressed, the enemy indiscriminately shelled civilian population centers in clear violation of the 1968 bombing halt understanding. The facts are clear. More than 120,000 North Vietnamese are now fighting in South Vietnam. There are no South Vietnamese fighting any place in North Vietnam. 12 of North Vietnam's 13 regular combat divisions have now left their own soil in order to carry aggressive war into the territory of their neighbors. Whatever pretext there was of a civil war in South Vietnam has now been stripped away. What we are witnessing here, what is being brutally inflicted upon the people of South Vietnam, is a clear case of naked and unprovoked aggression across an international border. There is only one word for it, invasion. This attack has been resisted on the ground entirely by South Vietnamese forces. No United States ground troops have been involved. None will be involved. To support this defensive effort for the South Vietnamese, I ordered attacks on enemy military targets in both North and South Vietnam by the air and naval forces of the United States. I have before me a report which I received, I have on my desk. I have here on my desk a report. I received this report this morning from General Abrams. He gives the following evaluation of the situation. The South Vietnamese are fighting courageously and well in their self-defense. They are inflicting very heavy casualties on the invading force, which has not gained the easy victory some predicted for it 3 years ago. Our airstrikes have been essential in protecting our own remaining forces. and an assistance sought within the needs and their efforts to protect their homes and their country from a common state. Now, Abrams predicts that there will be several more weeks of very hard fighting, in which some battles will be lost and some will be won by the South Vietnamese. But he is convinced that if we continue to provide air and sea support, the enemy will fail in its desperate gamble to impose a communist regime on South Vietnam, and that the South Vietnamese will then have demonstrated their ability to defend themselves on the ground against future enemy attacks. Based on this realistic assessment, General Abrams, after consultation with President Chu, Ambassador Bunker, Ambassador Porter, my senior advisors in Washington, I have three decisions to announce tonight. First, I have decided the Vietnamization has proved itself sufficiently that we can continue our program of withdrawing American forces without detriment to our overall goal of ensuring South Vietnam's survival of an independent country. Consequently, I am announcing tonight that over the next 2 months, 20,000 more Americans will be brought home from Vietnam. This decision is the full approval of President Q and General Abrams. It will bring our troop ceiling down to 49,000 by July 1st, a reduction of 500,000 men. And this is since the time moment that the Resistance Administration came to office. Second, I have directed Ambassador Porter to return to the negotiating table in Paris tomorrow, but with one very specific purpose in mind. We are not resuming the Paris talks simply in order to hear more empty propaganda and bombast from the North Vietnamese and Vietcong governments, but to get on with the constructive business. We are resuming the Paris talks with the firm expectation that productive talks leading to rapid progress will follow through all available channels. As far as we are concerned, the first order of business will be to get the enemy to halt his invasion of South Vietnam and to return the American prisoners of war. Finally, I ordered that our air and naval attacks on military installations in North Vietnam be continued until the North Vietnamese stop their offensive in South Vietnam. I have flatly rejected the proposal that we stop the bombing of North Vietnam as a condition for returning to the negotiating table. They sold that package to the United States once before in 1968, and we're not going to buy it again in 1972. Now let us look at the record. On July 1, we will have drawn over 90% of our forces from Vietnam in 1969. Before the enemy's invasion began, we had cut our air service in half. We have offered exceedingly generous peace. The only thing that we have refused to do is to accede to the enemy's demand to overthrow the lawfully constituted government of South Vietnam and to impose a communist dictatorship in its place. As you will recall, I have warned on a number of occasions in the past 3 years that if the enemy responded to our efforts to bring peace by stepping up the war, I would act to meet that attack for three reasons. Protect our remaining American forces, to prevent continuation of our withdrawal, and to prevent the imposition of a communist regime on the people of South Vietnam against their will, with the inevitable bloodbath that would fall for hundreds of thousands who have dared to oppose communist aggression. The air and naval strikes of recent weeks have been carried out to achieve these objectives. They have been directed only against military targets which support the invasion South Vietnam, and they will not stop until that invasion starts. The communists have failed in their efforts to will the people of South Vietnam politically. General Abrams believes they will fail in their efforts to conquer South Vietnam militarily. Their one remaining hope is to win in the Congress of the United States and among the people of the United States the victory they cannot win among the people of South Vietnam and on the battlefield of South Vietnam. The great question then is how we, American people, will respond to that challenge. Let us look at what this faces, not just for South Vietnam, but for the United States and the cause of peace and war. If one country, armed with the most modern weapons by a major power, can invade another nation and succeed in conquering it, other countries will be encouraged to do exactly the same thing in the Middle East, in Europe, and in other international dangerous lands. If, on the other hand, communist aggression fails in Vietnam, it will be discouraged elsewhere, and the chances for peace will be increased. If the communists win militarily in Vietnam, the risk of war in other parts of the world would be enormously increased. If, on the other hand, communist aggression fails in Vietnam, it will be discouraged elsewhere, and the chances for peace will be increased. Vietnam or any other country. We want no territory. We seek no bases. We have offered the most generous peace terms, peace with honor for both sides, with South Vietnam and North Vietnam, each respecting the other's independence. But we will not be defeated, and we will never surrender our friends to communist aggression. We have come a long way in this conflict. The South Vietnamese have made great progress and are now bringing the proud barrier in front of the back. We can now see the day when no more Americans will be involved there at all. But as we come to the end of this long and difficult struggle, we must be steadfast and we must not falter. All we have risked and all we have gained over the years now hangs in the balance during the coming weeks and months. If we now let down our friends, we shall surely be letting down ourselves and our future as well. If we now resist, future generations will thank America for courage and wisdom, for her courage and her vision at this day. If we now resist, future generations will thank America for her courage and her vision at this time of history. That is why I say, let us bring our men home from Vietnam. Let us end the war in Vietnam. And let us end it in such a way that the younger brothers and sons of the brave men who have fought in Vietnam do not have to fight in some other Vietnam at some time in the future. Any man who sits here in his office feels a profound sense of obligation to future generations. No man who sits here has the right to take any action which would advocate America's great tradition of world history. Earlier this year, I traveled to Peking on a historic journey for peace. Next month, I shall travel to Moscow, but I hope will also be a journey for peace. In the 18 countries I have visited as President of the United States, I have found great respect for the office of President of the United States. I have reason to expect, based on Dr. Kissinger's report, that I shall find that same respect for the office I hold when I visit Moscow. I do not know who will be in this office in years ahead, but I do know that future presidents will travel to nations abroad on journeys for peace as I have. If the United States betrays the millions of people who have relied on us in Vietnam, the President of the United States, whoever he is, will not deserve nor receive the respect which is essential if the United States is to play the great role we are destined to play in helping to build a new structure of peace in the world. It would amount to a renunciation of our morality, an abdication of our leadership among nations, and an invitation for the mighty to prey upon the weak all around the world. It would be to deny peace the chance peace deserves to have. This we shall never do. My fellow Americans, let us therefore unite as a nation. Let us therefore unite as a nation in a firm and wise policy of peace, not the peace of surrender, but the peace of honor. Not only peace in our time, but peace for generations.